Hello and welcome back to Conversations with Claire. Today, my guest is William Costello. This is going to be fun because we're going into uncharted territory for my podcast. He is a PhD student at the University of Texas, and he is studying evolutionary psychology, specifically incels, which if you're like me, then you didn't even know what that was until you were introduced to his work. So we'll get into that. So hello, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. Excited to get chatting.
Yeah. So I like to start with the how we met. And how we met to me is funny because, like you mentioned, somehow the internet, the algorithms, it places you in each other's path and who knows. And so I was able to see you and your work and your connection through Chris Williamson. And so that made me interested in what you're up to. And I do want to have conversations with interesting humans. And so I reached out to you and asked you to come on. And then you were like, hey, literally we saw each other in real life like 48 hours ago. And I had no idea. And so you were in a class at Onnit. Mm-hmm. And you were working out with, like, you were like partnered with somebody. And I was like being obnoxious about telling them how to deadlift better, right?
Yes. Yeah, no, it was very helpful. Very helpful.
Thank you. It was just so, it was so funny when you said that. I'm like, oh, man, the world is so small. It's so small. So anyway, that's the how we met, mm-hmm. which was rather brief. So I do want to take it back before we get into your studies and all of the stuff that you're up to professionally. I want to take it back just a little bit. You've now informed me that you're from Ireland. And then, so kind of take me through, like, where'd you grow up? And then we'll go deeper.
Sure. So I grew up in a place called Galway in the west of Ireland. And I moved to Birmingham, England when I was 23 years old. And I did my undergraduate degree in English and education. After that, I spent 5 or 6 years working in career guidance. I worked for a company that developed software for students to use in schools to help them make better employability decisions, better career decisions, and develop e-learning modules on that front. But my work often involved a big, long commute to and from work. And in that time, I turned my car into a little mobile university and just was addicted to podcasts and audiobooks. And the content I kept gravitating back towards was evolutionary psychology. I kept coming back to books about that and podcasts. And the more I listened to it, I began to get belief that maybe I could do this one day. So then in 2020, a very quiet year, I decided that was my time, that I would go back and do my master's. So in 2020, I started my master's in Brunel University in London in psychology, culture and evolution. And graduated from there and now started a PhD in University of Texas at Austin, which is honestly, for my field, it's my dream move because my supervisor is a guy called Dr. David Buss. And he and a couple of other colleagues founded the entire field of evolutionary psychology in the late 1980s, early 1990s. So to get to work with him, it's just like a dream. So I always joke that I would have followed him to the Antarctic to get to work with him. So Austin, Texas is just a bonus because it's a great place to be right now.
Yeah, he selected a good area for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had been here for decades.
Unbeknownst to him, yeah. He selected a great area for you.
Yes.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, so childhood in Ireland, was it like pretty rural? Was it pretty, was it a big city? What was that?
We lived in the countryside where I was growing up, but not too far from the city.
Wait, pig farm.
We own pig farms, yes, actually, randomly, but I was never the most agricultural of the sons, so
no.
I was always the black sheep that went his own way, was doing little bits of very different career trajectory, for sure, yeah.
That's funny, actually. So my background before being in Austin and really broadening practices, whatever, with fitness, was I spent a lot of years in the CrossFit space, and one of the, like, current favorites, like fan favorites and personal favorites, athletes wise, that's one of the highest level athletes. He's like a pig farmer. Like, his family is pig farmers. He lives in, I don't know, Iowa. I'm probably getting the state wrong. But anyway, that's just funny. That's the only connection I have to that. But I remember seeing that in an interview of you mentioning pig farming being something about where you come from.
Yes.
Love it.
But also a very small town. So to put that into perspective for you, my elementary school had 49 students in the entire school, 9 students in my entire year group, and just 2 teachers, a mother and daughter-in-law combo, who taught the whole school. So it was very, very small. So to have come this far and get to do a PhD at a university as good as the University of Texas, I never saw that in my future. So it's a,
right.
Yeah.
And then it's so interesting too, because, okay, so you do, that's where you grow up. You move to the UK so that you can study. You're now in a much, obviously you're in a university. There's more than 9 people in your class.
Mm-hmm.
So was that jarring?
It became jarring immediately upon moving to England, just a big, and also my secondary school in Ireland was all boys Catholic kind of school. So getting to be schooled alongside the other sex is very interesting, especially what I research now, evolutionary mating psychology.
Right.
It's very interesting. But I was always very interested in the psychology of what went on around romantic relationships, what makes people attractive, why people like what they like, why we seek the relationships we do, things like that. So that was always interesting to me. So maybe I should have seen, I suppose learning that you can actually study this formally was, I couldn't believe it.
So yeah.
I was hooked after that, yeah.
I love it. But also, I'm reading a book right now, I Don't Want to Talk About It. Have you heard of it?
I haven't heard of it. No.
Oh, it's written by Terence Real. Dr. Peter Attia, in his book Outlive, made reference to this literature. And the quote that he used was profound enough. And then he also shared that he then chose to go work with this guy on his own stuff. And so I'm reading it right now, and it's about depression in men. And there's a bit of it that I just read talking about schooling for boys and girls and the separation and the benefits, like the pros and cons to when you are schooled with just your gender and when you are schooled with both genders.
Yeah, I think there's something to that, because there's a lot of psychological differences between men and women, but specifically in adolescence. So men develop or mature a lot later than girls and women do. So to put that into perspective, in terms of impulse control, there's one study that shows that males don't get the level of impulse control of a 10-year-old girl until they're the age of 25. So that's a huge discrepancy between the two. So you can imagine, and when I talk to female friends, they talk about being very frustrated in school by the males.
Yeah.
Because they have to kind of be dragged down to their level. And we do have a problem. And this actually feeds into mating psychology, whereby women are outpacing men in education at crazy rates. And that means there's fewer highly educated men that they want to choose from as partners. So there's a problem with males dropping out of universities, colleges, schools, and even the workplace. They're not seeking status to the extent that they used to. And that's going to cause a lot of problems, I think.
I would agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is an incel?
Okay, so incel stands for involuntary celibate, and incels are an online subculture of men who come to the conclusion and form an identity around their perception that they can never form a sexual or romantic relationship. They think that that is inaccessible to them. They largely hang around in forums online on the internet and can get very, very misogynistic in their rhetoric, very resentful and very bitter about their lack of romantic prospects. In rare instances, some incels have actually turned violent and lash out at society and kill people, leaving behind ideological manifestos. And there's a kind of in this subculture, they have like a set of beliefs or a worldview. So one big part of the incel worldview is something called the black pill. And for incels, taking the black pill means to accept that they never had any chance in romantic life, that there was nothing they could ever do to improve their chances. It's kind of like a shoot-off of the red pill, which describes seeing the world as it really is compared to the blissful ignorance of the blue pill. So for incels, the black pill means to accept that it was over from the start and they never stood a chance and they should just lay down and rot, as they say, which is quite bleak language, but that gives you insight into their worldview.
So this is some Western medicine shit, which, by the way, there's like all of these pills that often don't work. Anyway,
yes.
Okay, so... Interesting. You literally, I mean, I knew about the black pill thanks to you. Mm. And then I've heard red pill. I didn't even know there was a blue option. Mm. So we have options. Why did, and thank you for explaining that. And that's, of course I pay attention a lot. I'm curious about humans enough to see some of these implications in real time of the successful women and all of that. So I love what you're doing and the light that you're shedding and the depth that you're going to like understand what's going on and maybe hopefully what we can do to not just accept a black pill, because to me that sounds like a pretty bleak thing. So you said rare instances, but about the aggression, that those things, I don't even know that I want to go there just yet though. Mm-hmm. Why did you get interested in this subset of individuals?
So for me, I was always interested in mating psychology. We're a sexually reproducing species. Every single human being alive today is the result of an unbroken evolutionary chain of ancestors who solved the problems of mating for long enough to reproduce. Mating is so important to humans that we build billion-dollar industries around it in the form of dating apps, cosmetic surgery to look more attractive as mates. We go to war to achieve mating success. We write poetry about it. It's the only game in town, as far as I'm concerned. And to think that there was this group called incels who had formed a strong sense of identity around feeling outside of that, feeling like that was inaccessible, that felt very interesting to me, to see what the effects of that feeling would be on a group.
Yeah.
I was also aware that incels, typically, ancestrally or throughout history, sexless young men or unpartnered young men in any society are really, really dangerous. And there is a civilizing force of having a female partner for young men. And it's dangerous when you have too many incels. And throughout history, we've had kind of institutions to deal with your surplus, sexless young men in a society. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you might send them to the monastery and there'd be some status afforded to them by saying, oh, well, you're celibate, but it's because of you're married to God or whatever, and that deals with your problem. You might send them to war. So think of the Vikings. Now, we typically think of the Vikings as this quite sexy guys from the Netflix show. Probably wasn't the case. They were more likely incels who were actually unmarried and kind of going to be causing trouble around the your own land.
Yeah.
So instead of that, they would send them on raids to go seek new lands. The Portuguese explorers who discovered the Americas, they were most likely incels.
Well, and if you think even those poor depictions of the Vikings situation, then often there's also this like very, very violent format to obtain no longer being that's portrayed there. And I'm not going to pretend to know much about that, but like that's there.
Yeah. And I mean, if we look at hunter-gatherer societies, so small scale societies around the world, which is typical of the environments we evolved in, very small scale societies with tribes of maybe 120 people. The main reason that tribes like that say that they go to war is mating, to achieve war brides, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And the anthropologists that visit these tribes, they tell them, well, the reasons we go to war is to spread democracy, free speech, and all these reasons, freedom of conscience. And they just laugh. They say, why would you risk your life going to war for any other reason other than to achieve mating success, so to get brides? And it's quite dark, some of these findings, but there's a, in the kind of archaeological record, when we look at the skulls that are found, or skeletons or skulls of human remains, mm-hmm. there's a conspicuous absence of fertile aged female skulls. They were almost never killed in these raids or wars. They were taken as war brides and absorbed into the winning tribe.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, war and mating is kind of intrinsically linked. And even now, incels would be the kind of the cocktail group that you would appeal to try and get them to go to war for you. So think about something like jihadi violence.
Mm-hmm.
They promise jihadi terrorists brides in this life or the next. They use that psychology to motivate young men who don't have many other prospects to go to war. And that's why incels maybe represent such a a dangerous group, because if you're getting this group that are kind of, it's actually a puzzle that incels aren't more violent. So yes, we have seen some level of violence, but in evolutionary psychology, we call this tendency towards violence for sexless young men, we call it the young male syndrome. And actually, considering everything we know about young male syndrome, this current iteration of incels aren't as dangerous or don't appear to be as violent as we might expect. And that's a little bit of a puzzle. And what we think might be going on there is that they're pacified by the internet, that mm-hmm. they're channeling their aggression into online worlds, towards pornography, is maybe satisfying sexual needs just enough, and they're aggressive on the internet. And that's not great, but it's better than them being aggressive out in the streets and being violent.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So this, I don't know that this qualifies for incels specifically, but this does make me think of, there are certain comedians that I've heard speak about their choices. So this isn't necessarily involuntary, but yet it's still a sexless life, and how it's something that, so they've openly spoken about their choice to, they receive rejection whenever they attempt towards a female. And so then they would rather opt for the easy route of, I'm going to stay home, order food, watch porn. Mm. And then they play that out over the course of time. And the ones that I've heard speak about it are like, yeah, that quote unquote worked for me for a period of time. And then it created a lot of downchain problems for me. And no, I no longer, and now I really have to fight this battle of no longer going down that road, mm-hmm. because that's not truly what I want. That's not truly fulfilling. I never walk away from that experience feeling like a better human, which is largely what we seem to need to feel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we're a exceptionally social species, the human. So yeah. To feel isolated from romantic pair bonds is one level of loneliness that's really difficult, but just broader loneliness as well. So yeah, going down that solitary path is quite dangerous. But you can see why it would be tempting for an individual who, let's take the typical incel who's very socially anxious, often has autism, and has received a lot of rejection. It's very difficult to say that they should definitely pick themselves up by their bootstraps and just keep trying. You know, to achieve romantic success, you do have to go through a lot of rejection, particularly as a young man.
Yes.
Before you have a lot of status, before you have much resources, you have to go through that rejection, often humiliation. It's often difficult and anxiety inducing. Mm. So you can understand why some individuals might say, this game isn't rewarding for me, I'm going to back out. And they choose, because the incel identity then gives them some positives too. So they get a coalitional alliance, the fraternity of their other fellow friends.
Yeah.
They get a common enemy. They get to, you know, say, oh, well, women are all bitches and it's their fault. They get a victimhood identity that's very appealing, especially on the internet. They get, like we've talked about, the kind of trolling language that they have. That's a kind of a niche interest that is appealing to lots of young men, particularly men with autism. And yeah, you can see why they trade the positives of the incel identity against an anxiety-inducing contest to try and achieve romantic success. Because the romantic contest, the mating game, it's quite ruthless, and it's something you're thrown into without any preparation. So you just become a teenager and bam, you're in it. Mm-hmm. And you have to get rejected and you have to compete with others and you have to try and attract someone. And no one is teaching you how to do this. Mm-hmm. And you just have to learn by trial and error. And it can be tough. And someone like me, I might say to you, yes, it's tough, but what's on the other side, the relationships, are worth it, right? They're worth any amount of rejection. And 99 rejections are worth the one time you get success. But who am I to say that that's true for every incel? You know, and I can imagine why it's very difficult for a young man to say enough is enough and to back out. Now, I do believe that romantic relationships are some of the most rich conscious experiences we can access. So I don't think that the opportunity cost of a generation of young men backing out seems a high price for me. Mm-hmm. And if we can intervene and help these individuals, I think we should.
Okay, so that's what you're trying to achieve by choosing to study this in such depth, is to be able to give these individuals more tools for their tool belt to be able to say, this may not be a worthwhile thing to just accept, and maybe we need to find ways to around this, mm-hmm. even if we are the person who struggles with it more than the average person, which I, like you said, I mean, I look at you men and I'm like, dude, that's tough, you know, right. like for a lottery, and we have our own stuff as chicks for sure. Mm-hmm. But the race that you have to run for the rest of the world to validate your worthiness is like, I do not envy it. Mm-hmm. And like I said, us chicks over here, we got our whole other mess, but it is just, I definitely specific people are coming to my mind, and the conversations I've gotten to have about their journeys, whether it was young men choosing to date some women that were much older than them because they could have access to them, and they could not have access to women their age at their younger ages in life mm-hmm. until they had achieved, you know, another example would be a friend that I'd spoke to you about before we started recording, who this gentleman's in his 40s. And he was just saying, now I've gotten far enough in life where I've gotten enough outwardly perceived success that now I get the opportunity to maybe have some sort of courting relationship with these women that I didn't previously have access to, but the quality of the connection is pretty poor there. So I'm still like, it's just, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah. You touched on some really good points, and the link between men's status and their, value as a romantic partner is so intrinsically linked, and they affect each other. So when you don't have any status as a man, it's very difficult to attract a female partner. But then also not being able to attract a female partner lowers your status as well. So it kind of, it's a bi-directional effect. It affects each other. So you don't get a partner without the status. Not getting a partner lowers your status even more. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a race to the bottom. But yeah, I think you're right that it's very difficult for people to acknowledge the male suffering in this arena, because the sexual domain or romantic relationships is always seen as historically being very patriarchal and has punished women more, and women's sexuality is controlled more everywhere around the world. And that's true, but hidden in there is these kind of losers in the mating game, the male losers who find it very difficult to achieve success. And throughout ancestral history, far more men have failed to reproduce than females have. So there's a lot of variance of the success among men. Some men get a lot of success, many men get none, whereas women, most will get something, which is interesting.
You're fascinating. My brain is doing so much right now, and I'm like, where do I even go? This is cool. So let's go to what you touched on and expand upon it. Successful women. Mm-hmm. Now we're getting higher educations. We have access to more resources. We're given the green light better today than ever before. I can speak to it, you know, myself, of there's a lot of opportunity. Yet again, I have my own subset of problems of mm-hmm. there have been a number of times where maybe something would have been pulled from me, like an opportunity I would have thought that I had received had been pulled away from me because I was unwilling to reciprocate mm-hmm. something romantic. So that's a whole other, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. But nonetheless, we have access to resources and information unlike ever before. And at least in the country that I live in, I'm allowed to be successful. Mm-hmm. I'm allowed to be curious. I'm allowed to ask questions. And so that does change the game, because now my expectations of a partner, they just went up.
Mm, interesting. And before I get into any of that, I do want to make sure you've mentioned a few times that each sex has their own set of problems.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I very much agree. And I don't want any of the listeners to think that I'm saying, oh, just men have it worse or whatever.
No.
What is really important is for each sex to try as hard as they can with perspective taking about the other. And the psychological sex differences between the two make that very difficult, because, for example, men might see... So I'm often asked the question, are there female incels? And originally, I would have agreed with most incels and said no, because most women, even if they're unattractive, can go out and get sex or a relationship if they want. It might not be the exact sex or the exact relationship that they want, but they can get something. And for incels, or perhaps for men in general, some is always better than none, right? The old joke is that sex is like pizza. There's good pizza and there's pizza. There's no bad pizza. But for women, there's bad pizza, right? I think a lot of women would prefer no sex or no relationship to a bad one because it's so costly. It's so upsetting. It's a lot of investment. So incels are really committing a failure of cross-sex mind reading when they're thinking, oh, these women are so privileged, they can get sex or a relationship whenever they want. But if it's not the relationship or sex that the woman wants, she might as well be incel. It's amounts to the same thing. It's worse than nothing. Uh-huh. So it's a failure of cross-sex mind reading.
Okay.
Whereas women may not understand what it's like to be sexually invisible. Right, it's probably seen as a hassle, the amount of sexual attention most women get, right? So the understanding the mindset of a man who feels sexually invisible is quite difficult. So I try as much as I can, and our lab does a lot of work on cross-sex mind reading to try and see how accurate or inaccurate each sex is at understanding the mind of the other. Striving to try and see things from the other sex's perspective is very important.
That just to me makes me think, even if it's not, you know, you personally, or it's not your potential romantic partner, like there are probably people in you. So I'm just going to, I all the time relate back to what I know, intimately. And what do I know intimately is recovery, alcoholism, addiction. And that's a huge thing for me personally. And so I understand, when I speak about that, I'm like, this matters to pretty much everyone, because if it's not you that's suffering, someone that you care about is. And if it's, maybe it's a family member, oftentimes this is a broad enough problem that it often is. But if it's not, then it's at least someone in your proximity in some way. And this disease has a unique ability to get everybody else around it sick too. And so, no, we all kind of should care to know a little bit. So the same principle could be applied here, where maybe this isn't something I personally deal with, but I can think of individuals in my life, even if they're just my friends, that like they could be suffering from this, and this does matter. And maybe I want to be a better friend to them, and therefore curiosity is a good idea.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally agree. And priming people to think about, their brother or their male cousin or their female cousin, someone they're invested in, to think about those in relation to these problems helps them understand or helps them to care. So yeah, very important.
Okay, so do we want to go, yet again, so many spots. Do we want to go into the whole like education system situation, the impact that has as far as women being higher education? I guess maybe we should just go straight to like, what are some like tools? So your work is because you ultimately want to help these people and help people understand them and help them have more resources. And so like, what does that look like?
So luckily, mate value, as we call it, your value as a romantic partner in this kind of contest arena, can always be improved, particularly if you're a man. You can always accrue more status, you can get more resources, which kind of male attractiveness is largely based around. You can always improve your physical attractiveness. There are always things you can do. So encouraging incels to have an internal locus of control. They very much have an external locus of control. They very much think that there's nothing they can do to affect their chances. So I think there are workshops you could do, and there's some research to show that workshops to improve confidence in romantic contexts do work. But it's interesting because whenever you talk about this stuff, like, oh, you want to train guys on how to get laid, it's seen as like a very insidious bad thing to do. Sure. Or even guys wanting to make themselves more attractive with the goal of getting romantic success, of getting a female partner, it's seen as kind of manipulative. It's almost weird that we want it to just be organic and nobody try any more than they need. Just pretend you're not trying and let the winners win and the losers lose. There's kind of something insidious about pretending. I don't like that. I don't like when people pretend that you can't improve in this arena. I think that's very, that's unfair. And people who kind of say that, who say, oh no, you can't train people on how to improve in this arena, you know, they're often the people who have already achieved romantic success. And it's fair enough for them to say. But there are others who maybe could improve. So the way I would see kind of workshops on how to improve your romantic competency that you can learn about. Learn about what does the opposite sex want in a partner? How can I show that to them? How can I improve myself as a partner and make myself someone that women are attracted to? You can learn that stuff, and I think it is worth learning. And the way we would see it is that right now, dating apps are very, very popular. And 20 years ago, they were seen as very weird. And that if you got your partner on a dating app, that was kind of odd.
Yeah, right? Like, don't talk about it.
Yeah, a bit of a stigma associated with it.
Yeah.
I think that in 15, 20 years, we might see generations of young men who aren't as stigmatized for, you know, taking a class on how to improve themselves as a romantic partner or to learn about what do women want in a partner. There might be reduced stigma, and we could say, yeah, that's just a normal part of education. Or maybe it could be baked into the education system as part of sexual and relationship education. Like I said earlier, you're kind of just thrown into this contest when you become a teenager, and you're not really taught, well, how do I make myself more attractive? What should I do? And you're kind of, and if you leave a vacuum for that, you'll get someone like Andrew Tate to fill it. And he'll, you know, he achieves a level of romantic success in one way.
Yeah.
And if no one is training you or teaching you how to do it in any other more holistic way, young men will flock to that idea. Yeah. It's very motivational for men to improve themselves and to seek status to try and achieve a romantic partner. And that itself is kind of problematized sometimes. And I don't know why, because for men, it's so intuitive to want to improve yourself to get a romantic partner. That's mm-hmm. so motivational. It's get the goal, get the girl, right? That was always like the Hollywood kind of dream or the Disney dream. And that's kind of been problematized. Even Barack Obama, in his autobiography, he wrote a passage about how he, in university, he started reading different types of literature to impress different types of girls.
Mm-hmm.
And most men reading that would be like, yep, that makes total sense. We would try any different trick or whatever. anything you'd try. And it's motivational to improve yourself or to make yourself appealing to women.
Totally.
And he was pilloried for it. They said, oh, how manipulative of him to want to, you know, basically trick. And I don't know. I think we need to get away from that. I think it's motivational for young men to think it's worth improving yourself so that you can achieve romantic success. And that, you know, that has kind of motivated men to strive for status, strive for success for hundreds of thousands of generations. And now it doesn't seem to be as on the forefront of young men's minds. They don't seem to be as motivated. And I think that's sad.
Well, and all signs show, everything points in the direction of like, hey, they're not thriving, you know? So it's like, hey, that's not working. Like this mm-hmm. lack of motivation, who cares where the motivation came from? Mm-hmm. If it was attracting a partner or whatever, like, so be it. They're now motivated to do something worthwhile in life, even if it's just get jacked. And then spoiler alert, most of the time girls don't even really care, but they do care. They do care, but like, they don't care as much as your other dude friends. And that's kind of a bummer to you. that reminds me, my boyfriend, Jimmy, he had been lifting at Onnit around me for quite a while. And this is just funny. I just didn't know, you know, he's got videos of me in the background. He's lifting crazy weights, doing impressive feats of fitness. And I'm just blissfully unaware. Meanwhile, I'm sure every other male in the gym is very aware of everything he's up to over there because it's like impressive. I'm just like, beep, boop, don't care, whatever. Yes. You're just another one of the primates in here. Anyway, you know, and then finally his brain was what got me interested enough. But anyway, yeah.
That's exactly what the research shows, by the way, that women like muscularity
yes.
a little bit,
yes.
but nowhere near as much as men think they do.
Totally. Yeah. And so yet again, but then all of the reasons why getting muscular and so on are going to be beneficial for your mental health and so on, even if you, so sure, there's the motivator of attract mm-hmm. a mate, and that should be like, that's a good reason to do the thing.
Yes.
But then in addition to that, we can look at it through the lens of longevity and health and like get jacked anyway. Like who cares if you get the chick, you're going to need it to like have a quality of life. So just do it. You know, movement is medicine. It's better medicine than most of the medicine out there.
And it shows your personality qualities too, to show yes. that you're disciplined, you're organized, you're kind of have enough time to invest in yourself. So it's more than just the aesthetic. It's kind of what it says about what type of person you are.
Yeah.
And becoming that type of person makes you a better partner
yeah.
if you're disciplined and organized and motivated. But yeah, I definitely agree.
Well, and I like what you said too, is the whole locus of control being external and bringing it internal. Mm-hmm. To me, that feels tangible because I can hear a lot of information and not really know what to do with it all the time. And that just to me works as far as, okay, so if you have control over the situation and I don't, there's nothing I can do. Mm-hmm. But if I then get told that narrative is bullshit and it's not serving you, so maybe go ahead and take some agency, mm-hmm. then like I can do something with that. If it's no longer all your fault, mm-hmm. and there's something I can do, great.
That's why the black pill is so seductive as a mindset for incels, because it absolves them of responsibility. If you believe that you never stood a chance and that the deck was stacked against you and there's nothing you could do to change your prospects anyway, then you don't need to keep trying. Mm-hmm. You can give up all the anxiety, you can give up all the effort it would take, and it would take effort. That's why incels kind of drag each other down a lot. So they would even kick each other out of forums if they report any semblance of romantic success. So it's very much kind of dragging each other down. And this is where this current modern day incel movement is different to incel movements in the past. So ancestrally and throughout other species, incel males would form coalitions to try and take down the top guy who was having a lot of romantic partners.
Yeah, give them some options.
Yes, they're kind of incels called the
Tate's
top
going
guy,
down.
Chad.
Tate is done. Yeah, what's that other guy? Dan, done.
Yeah, take him down. Yeah, and give more egalitarian opportunity.
Just kidding.
Whereas
taking a lot.
Modern day incels now, they're kind of galvanizing around victimhood and encouraging each other to just stop trying. So that's very different. That's new. They're not, forming coalitions for sexual access. They're doing precisely the opposite, forming coalitions to encourage each other to stop trying. But something you mentioned earlier about women maybe not being as attracted to the muscularity in men, it got me thinking of something. So ancestrally, two of the main reasons why women needed male partners is bodyguards, to protect them from the hostile forces of nature that existed ancestrally, and resources. Now, neither of those things are as salient in 2024. Women are outpacing men in education and in the workplace up until the age of 30. They're killing it in the workplace. They're earning their own money. You know, that's all good. We've also outsourced bodyguarding to the state. So neither of those elements are as salient for women in looking for a romantic partner anymore. So it might be the case that for the last number of years, many women were actually settling with men that they otherwise wouldn't have wanted out of strict monogamy norms, that they felt pressured that they had to find someone.
Yep.
Or that they financially were dependent on them. So if you take away those two things, women, modern day men are actually competing with singlehood for women. So women are electing to choose singlehood rather than settle for a guy that they don't want. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of bleak as well. And we're also noticing an increase in women prioritizing physical attractiveness in men more. So given that they don't need the resources, they don't need the protection anymore, they just want pretty. So there's a lot of data that shows that male physical attractiveness is becoming more and more important. So men are in the gym way more. Yeah, yeah. Everyone you know is a recreational bodybuilder now. Yeah. Every peer of mine, my age.
Yeah. A recreational bodybuilder. Or you're
everyone,
something. You're in the gym. That's how we met.
Everyone's in the gym. Yeah. That started in the 80s and it's just skyrocketed since. You've got even male makeup is becoming more popular. Men are becoming more fashionable, taking care of their skin. All of these things, their fashion. They also have increased rates of body dysmorphia.
Yes.
Male body dysmorphia is on track to overtake female body dysmorphia in the next decade.
I totally
believe
it. That
is unheard of. Yep. You know, and a lot of that is to do with, you know, gym culture or whatever. But that's because, you know, that physical attractiveness could be becoming increasingly important to women.
And I can speak intimately to that as someone who works in the fitness industry and is constantly surrounded by fitness professionals. I can absolutely confirm for you that, like, in general in the fitness world, people seem to have some form of body dysmorphia. That's very common. Wow. Not saying all, but very many. Yeah. But men specifically, I've found it shocking. Maybe not shy. It's definitely been just a repeated pattern that when I get to speaking to men, it's like their desire to improve, feeling like it's never good enough. Mm-hmm. It's just, there always needs to be more. There always needs to be something different. I need to be more lean. I need to be more jacked. Maybe I need to take the next performance enhancing drug. Maybe I'll try this thing. You know, I need to be strong. You know, it just, it never ends. And as much as for women, it's largely been, we just need to get smaller. And mm-hmm. thankfully, I don't know, in the world I live in, it's like, no, take up space, you know, mm-hmm. and it seems to be growing in popularity, hopefully. Mm-hmm. But anyway, no, that's, yeah, checks. Mm. Okay, here we go. So the online thing, I've heard you speak to that as well, and the impact that like social media has mm-hmm. on optionality for partnership of now, I don't have to just look within my small town, yeah. but now I can look halfway across the globe if I want to.
Yes. And specifically to link it back to the previous point about the increased importance of physical attractiveness, that increased importance tracks alongside the exposure of more media. So starting in the 1980s when like TV was becoming more popular and increased right along with all social media now is going to increase that so much because you're competing with, you know, the competition, the intrasexual competition that you're competing against is men on the internet, right? And there's always going to be someone way more jacked in the perfect lighting and women are consuming that media all day, every day, right? So that affects things too. So it's going to kind of ratchet up how important you think physical attractiveness is because you're looking at your competition and you're thinking, wow, that's who I'm up against. I got to improve. Whereas we evolved in a world where you might have encountered a couple of dozen potential mates in a lifetime and right. a couple of dozen potential competitors. And, you know, it wasn't that hard to be towards the top of that end or whatever. But now you're competing against the entire world and the perfect lighting, everything. So it's very different. Also, the online dating affects our mating psychology in lots of different ways. So primarily, it's that exposure to this idea that you have unlimited supply of mates. So like I said, ancestrally, you would have encountered a couple of dozen potential mates. Now, you encounter more in one afternoon on Tinder than you would have in a lifetime mm-hmm. back then. So that gives you a reluctance to commit to long term. Mm-hmm. The dating apps also prioritize what we call short term mating qualities. So they emphasize the physical attractiveness way more than other qualities. You know, attraction is very dynamic. When you meet someone, even if you didn't think they were that good looking, sometimes you can just click or they could be very funny. They get an opportunity to vibe well with you. That is all stripped away in dating apps. So take something like height, which is kind of important to me because I'm a bit shorter.
Hey, and my boyfriend calls himself a short king, okay?
I'll go with short king, yes. Embrace the short king. Let's popularize that. But take that, and if you imagine women setting their height filter to 6 foot and over, they're just filtering out great guys.
Absolutely.
Just in one fell swoop. And it reduces the pool of men that they're even considering. And when men are in the minority in any sex ratio, when there's fewer men that women are aiming at, then they are even more reluctant to commit to long term because it's like, well, why would I? If lots of women are wanting just a small few of us, I'm not going to commit to just one. So all these sex ratios and things like that get extra pronounced online. And also we evolved to make our mating decisions sensually about scent, voice, all of these were very, very important. And yes, you have some apps who are building in voice note technology and things like that, that I would encourage men to make use of because voice is a very attractive mate feature to women.
But get specific there. Like, what do you mean when you say that?
So the depth of your voice
yeah.
is actually a strong intrasexual competition kind of feature. So,
but so you're saying there's something they can do about that? Like if they can make their voice deeper?
I'm not sure about that, but it's a piece of sensual information that is taken away on most dating apps.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We do know from research that when you introduce an attractive female to a group around men, they lower their voice and women heighten their voice when an attractive male is introduced.
Interesting.
So this stuff is going on. So yeah, I mean, it just, what I'm getting at is that all this information, this dynamism of real life is stripped away on a dating app, and you're reduced down to your height, your job, your education status,
yep.
and it all gets more unequal.
Yeah. I think this is just such a good, like, bring it to light and look at it for what it is moment, because then I personally did find that if I thought you male were too pretty, you probably came with your own subset of problems I didn't want to mess with.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know where that stands on the scale. And I do understand that. I think that, like, it's funny whenever male friends ask for advice from me in regards to females, I'm like, full disclaimer, one, I don't know her inner workings. Two, I think I might be an alien. So that being said, then, like, I'll tell you what I think. But because so many of those outward, I definitely, you know, smarts is so paramount for me. And yet again, I'm never going to get that by looking at your photo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are other things to me that are just, and I guess the challenge to this in my brain is, like, I want to speak to the women listening and just say, like, what are we trying to get out of the deal?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so you get to choose, but, like, is long-term partnership something that you actually desire or not? And you get to choose. And if it's not, then revoke the things that would be important if that's the case. But if it is, then we have to take into consideration more than their height and things like that. Like,
yeah.
those. And so yet again, that's where I kind of feel like an alien, you know, now being the one that's like, no, I need to be courted slowly. Like, you know, I needed, like, that was one of the things that Jimmy had to just be chill, you know, cause like, you come on too fast and I will run.
Interesting.
Yeah. But I don't, that may be just a progression of life now being in my 30s, you know, experiencing enough of the other and recognizing that those behaviors were not of service to what I actually want. And we're all just in the middle of it. Right. But like,
but it's very difficult because women are, and men are given the impression, oh, there could always be something better out there, right? It's like the ultimate FOMO. You're surrounded in big cities, attractive people all around you. You go on an app, there's hundreds of attractive people in one afternoon. It's very difficult to not jump ship straight away and to persist with one partner and say, oh, I'm going to see where this is going. You know, people talk about the ick. That one little thing happens and the ick is, they're done for, right?
What a term. Okay, wait. So would you advocate for resisting this type of narrative?
Yeah. I mean, there is this famous psychologist called Dr. Lori Gottlieb, and she has a book that's called Marry Him, The Case for Settling for Mr. Good Enough. And she talks about this thing of, giving it time, actually seeing what someone has to offer and being more kind of intentional and not just running at the first ick or something like that. Because that's going to, you know, you're just going to get in this cycle of spotting the first thing that's not exactly perfect. And no one's going to be exactly perfect all the time. And if you dump someone straight away for the first ick, you know, you're going to be trapped on this treadmill of constantly serially dating for a long time. But on the other side of things, like I mentioned, would I give that advice to my sister if I had one? I don't know. It's hard to give the advice to women to settle when, you know, they don't have to.
Yeah.
They'd rather stay single. But it's kind of this idea of there's always something better out there. And it's really true. There might. But they're reluctant to give it a go as well because there might be something better out there for them too.
Yeah.
And we know from all psychology research that too much choice actually reduces your psychological well-being. You're actually happier in shopping circumstances when there's only 5 pairs of jeans in the shop and you choose your favorite one and you're happy.
Right.
Whereas now, you're constantly exposed to the potential option, oh, there could be someone better out there, which is not good for psychological well-being.
Yeah, why would you advocate for it? Because there seems to be sufficient evidence available to us to prove the point that, like, there are so many benefits to be gained from, like, so we are people who have a tendency to be hardwired for hard work, even though we try to avoid that because pain is something we don't like, whatever. We seem to, once we are willing to work hard, be stoked that we did that thing, like, consistently. So relationship success mm-hmm. is hard work. Mm-hmm. And anybody also, then I'm just like, okay, the optionality of there could be something else better out there and whatever, like the ick. I'm like, I'm sure that I have 14 different things that would cause somebody to have the ick, and more than that. You know what I mean? So like, remember, like, you're also imperfect. Mm-hmm. You're also going to mess up.
Yeah. And like, and you speak to very successful couples, and you talk to them about their early dating days, yeah. and they inevitably have some story of, oh, I didn't quite like his house when I went to visit first. He had, you know, yeah. boxes on top of his wardrobe or something. And it becomes this fun little story.
You know, but what if you build enough success that now you can hire a maid that can get rid of the boxes you didn't like? Yeah. I mean, what if you work together to solve the problem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, you inevitably have these stories where they're happy they looked past the ick or whatever it might be. But yeah, so it's people are kind of getting spooked too easily, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so I love humanness, like, mm-hmm. a lot. And so I want you to kind of share some of your own personal experiences with, like, this stuff in real life, because you've done a ton of studying. You're probably like, wait, what? No, we're just going to talk about this. But, like, what are some things that, like, so this is of interest to you because it's something you're fascinated with because mm-hmm. you desire partnership in some capacity, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, what are some of your, like, personal experience learnings that you're comfortable sharing?
Well, I've always found, like, romantic relationships very gratifying and very, you know, like, they're some of the richest conscious experiences we have access to. So that's why I think it's better to help more people cultivate those. You know, it's a big concern. Romantic relationships are a huge concern for every human. They're like, who's with who? Who's stealing whose partner? Who's yeah. cheating on who? Always on our mind.
Every TV show that is yes. that has any viewership today is about that in some capacity.
Exactly. So it's the only game in town as far as I'm concerned. From my own life, I would say the height thing is quite personal. So I've been with on a lot of dates or in relationships with women who they say things to me like, oh, I kind of forget that you're not that tall. Or I didn't notice that you weren't that tall. Or they don't believe me when I say what height I actually am. And maybe I have just really good posture or something else. But I think other qualities are helping them see past that.
Yeah.
So I think that can. And incels always, you know, I kind of, by being in romantic relationships myself, I disprove a lot of the incel kind of rhetoric about the importance of height. And it is, don't get me wrong, I'm aware of the research on how important height is to women. Mm-hmm. But I think perhaps increasingly less so. And I think if you show other qualities, women are often willing to look past that and are glad they did if they do.
Yeah. And I think, too, it's just, you know, there are multiple... These are just my opinions, you know, but there are so many things that are within your control. Mm. And with anything in life, if we're going to make this productive, sure, building out awareness around what's really going on, getting a hard look at the hard facts mm-hmm. about this stuff is useful. And then go, okay, well, my height isn't really something that I'm going to be able to do anything about.
Yes.
But what I can do is grow my biceps,
yes.
dress well, keep my hair cut, you know, whatever, right? There are things that are within my control. So I'll just focus energy on those. I can get smarter. Mm-hmm. I can continue. Like there, like I said, it's the smarts for me that are like, if you display that, I probably want to hang out as long as you're not a dick. Yeah. Right. And then at some point we get enough, have a high IQ high enough, and then EQ might go down a little bit, but yeah. anyway,
no, I agree with you, but now I'm just playing devil's advocate for incels.
Do it.
They will hear us saying that and they'll say, yes, but none of that personality, IQ, none of that matters until you're a certain level of attractiveness. And I think that is true to some extent. There is like a threshold that people have to meet for most people where other qualities get to come into play.
Okay.
So for example, with height, I'm 5'7". So I think that might be just on the threshold, but if I went down to maybe 5'4 or 5'2, it becomes a lot harder. And no amount of other qualities for many women would allow that to override. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that does, and I do have sympathy for
such
men. No,
I can see what you're saying.
Situations, because I don't want incels to hear this and be like, oh, he's just demeaning. Because it's very easy to say to incels, oh, the problem isn't your attractiveness, it's all the other qualities, right? And that may be true in a lot of cases, but it's kind of, it does a little bit of a disservice because to some extent it's about attractiveness, right? You know, nobody actively chooses a partner who's unattractive. You know?
Totally. And you're so right. I'm grateful that you bring that up because the eternal optimist in me will like take and do anything she can with anything to make it flowery.
No, that's right.
But like to a point where I just turn a blind eye to any, you know. So then do you have anything that like, so the individual is 5 foot flat or they're 4 foot, whatever, or I don't know, let's get low enough there with the height topic that now it becomes a genuine problem of like, man, we really have lowered the percentage of women who are going to overlook that thing, no matter how jacked, how smart, how clean cut, how all the things that you can control. So someone who's really in this lower demographic, whatever, like to them, then what would you say?
So the advice I give to incels or to men who are struggling is to focus on building a smaller niche. So humans can build status hierarchies. We can build multiple status hierarchies. There's not just one.
Yeah.
So I give the example for myself. I don't think I would succeed in getting a romantic partner in the nightclubs of Miami. I just think I wouldn't stand out as appealing there. But I might stand out as appealing in my world of academic conferences. I might ask a killer question from the Q&A or, you know, impress somebody with my talk or my research. So that's my arena. Yep. Like you can build any different amount of arenas. And the world is built for that now.
Yep.
If you go on the internet and no matter what niche interest you have, there's probably a community meetup for it in Austin, right? It's like, you
absolutely.
Know, there's any amount of status hierarchies you can build. So focusing on getting into a smaller corner where you might impress somebody than trying to compete with the, you know, pickup artists in Miami or gym bros in the gym, whatever it is.
Yep.
Choose your arena. Does that make sense?
Totally. And then that allows, there you go. You just took agency back over something that we just stated previously was this, oh, the world opened up and now we have options. So then it makes it harder to stand out. But then yet you just flipped it and said, however, there's all these niche places to hang out online and so on. So actually then get clear. And then I think too, you know, with the nightclubs in Miami, like what are the odds that I'm not saying impossible, but that you find the partner that you want in that room.
Exactly right.
You're like, not only are you choosing to go into the conference that is the academia and say the question that might whatever, but also that you put yourself now in a room where you might like that woman back.
Exactly. That's where you're going to find the partner that's right for you. The partner that won't care about your height as much as the girls in Miami, let's say.
Sure. Sure. Okay. So the recent work that you've been doing, do you want to elaborate any more on any of the, like, cause I mean, you're currently on spring break, which is what's kind of given you access to have a bit, which woo, like you're in your 30s, spring break. And then you're just working on things you weren't able to. Yeah. That's so cool too. Like you know, you touched on that you've moved here to Austin because largely of this, supervisor.
Yes, that's right.
And how I love that you have gotten yourself to a place where you've been fascinated enough for so long that now this is like you occupy the rooms of someone you've looked up to for so long. I just love to speak to that from a random tangent on like the things that you can accomplish in life when you're just willing to continue to like show up and learn and try. So you're passionate about your work and you're working on projects right now that you aren't able to during the school year. So what are, like, tell me what are you into that we haven't, you know, unpacked?
Okay, so I'll briefly summarize our most recent incel research, and then I'll maybe tell you about some other projects that are nothing to do with incels that maybe could be interesting to you too. So we recently published some work on behalf of the UK Government Commission for Countering Extremism, and incels are often looked at in terms of, an extremism worry lens, like a terrorism threat or the violence, the potential for violence to others. And that is a threat. But our research keeps finding the same story over and over again, that incels are most dangerous to themselves. So we see incredibly high rates of suicidality, really poor mental health among incels. So in terms of their suicidality levels, 1 in 5 incels in our most recent sample said that they thought about committing suicide every single day for the last 2 weeks. So that's incredibly high rates. So when we think about incels in terms of extremism, I think extremism in incels most likely looks like suicidality rather than violence towards others. That's a big take home I'd like to leave with your listeners, because people tend to think of incels as dangerous to others, but they're most dangerous to themselves.
What was the percentage that you said there?
So 1 in 5, so 20% of incels thought about suicide every day for the last 2 weeks.
Yet again, we should just all care about this, mm-hmm. because if there is a human in your world that you love or care about in any capacity who mm-hmm. could potentially be struggling for this, like, you don't even know, you know, maybe you haven't had that conversation, like, right. maybe you're not digging too deep into their personal life, but you can think of somebody that you like care for that may be struggling in this department. It would just matter to try to show support to them however you could, because yet again, that I would imagine that those incels are also suffering from isolation and a variety of different things as well. And that is a recipe for disaster. Mm-hmm. So anyway,
And that actually tracks with the research that shows that the two biggest predictors of male suicidal ideation are, number one, failure in heterosexual mating, and number two, feeling like you're a burden to your kin. So incels are very highly likely to be neet, so not in education, employment, or training. So, and they're also highly likely to be still living with their parents into adulthood. So those two components, they are so salient for incels. They're like big predictors of suicide, and incels hit them both heavy.
Okay. This young male, so on. Mm. So these are males that, hold on. And I may be so far off base, but what about potentially, like, does this demographic qualify for incel? I don't know. Asking the question. Men married with families who now sexual relations have been removed from, because that happens. Mm-hmm. Is that an incel?
Yes, I believe so. And we get some incels like that in our data. Now, that's not typical incel. What typical incel we categorize as someone who feels like they can't attract a romantic partner at all. But involuntarily celibate, within a marriage, that is common. Yeah, dead bedroom and things like that. And it's difficult to know how to handle that.
So yet again, this just makes me think, there you go. That could impact more people than you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess it's a little bit different in that, at least from a self-esteem perspective, that person knows that they've been chosen or that they've been selected. Because for incels, it's about more than just the sex. So they could always just go and see a sex worker, right? And that would, solve the sexual component. But that's not quite being sexually selected. Mm-hmm. There's no status afforded to a guy who says, oh, look, at this weekend I went out and paid $500 and had a great experience with a sex worker. No one is kind of admiring him for that. Yeah. Whereas being a man of sufficient kind of accomplishments to attract someone, that's a boost to your status. So incels are looking to be sexually selected rather than the sex per se.
Okay.
So at least the person with a dead bedroom marriage, they might be getting some of the benefits of that relationship outside of the sex as well. And also just that feeling like that they could, even if that person, they left that person, they could go on attract someone else. Mm. You know, their self-esteem might not be so low as a typical incel who feels like they just can't attract a partner at all.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, I still think that's a demographic worth, maybe they don't qualify as a specific incel, but that's also just another huge area of, you get further along in life and you don't take the same actions and have the same behaviors that you had to attract the partner. And then, and it's just, I have compassion for it, I guess, is the only thing. Obviously, I cannot identify with it, mm-hmm. but I can see places where it's taking place, where it's just, these are good people mm-hmm. who are suffering from a variety of different things that could cause depression and all sorts of.
Yeah. At all stages of mating, there are problems. So there's problems in attracting the mate. Then you have the problem of retaining the mate, keeping them, stopping someone else from mate poaching them. You got a lot of problems. you got to be on alert.
The only game that everyone must play.
Exactly.
You don't get out alive and you must play. Aren't you happy to be here?
Yeah.
Okay. So So that's the research that you've recently finished up with, identifying that, okay, these people are having some suicidal ideation at rates that are really noteworthy.
We also find really high levels of autism, which I mentioned before, and that might kind of compound the romantic problems, because we know that people with autism really struggle with social cues. And we maybe forget how new and this important factor of flirting is. So flirting to attract a partner is very, very evolutionary novel. If we think ancestrally, I think something like 69% of relationships or marriages were arranged by parents throughout our ancestral history.
That's kind of a funny number. That's easy to remember.
Interesting. Anyway. Yes, exactly. but yeah, so, you know, your parents would have helped you. They no longer do in contemporary Western societies. I don't even know if your friends help each other anymore. Do friends even set each other up on dates? That feels like it's something that's gone away a little bit, you know?
I think that good friends in healthy relationships with one another, and in maybe like if they're living a high quality of life, probably help with that more.
Yeah, I think that's a good route for relationships to flourish, or the friendship to relationship pipeline.
Totally.
But the problem is people are not having friendships at all as much anymore anyway. There's a massive loneliness crisis. But anyway, this idea of flirting being so important, you know, it used to be that your parents or your kin would help set you up, or that you would just, if you got a job, let's say in the 1950s in America, a man would kind of know if he got a good job, he'd probably get a wife along with it. That's no longer the case. The number one word in the Oxford Dictionary this year was riz. You know, have you heard of riz? So charisma.
Stop.
Right? Riz was number
one.
Yeah,
rizzing a girl or rizzing a guy.
You've got to have riz. You've got to have presence. And, you know, that's so alienating for a lot of men with autism, right? They don't have riz, right? That's difficult. So, yeah, the more emphasis that's put on that, the more people that are kind of not going to be good at that. It's
Do
difficult.
You think that encouraging them to lean into their lack of riz would be beneficial? Or is it like, oh, I don't know.
Maybe. I mean, there's qualities.
It's just like the short king thing of like, let's just lean in, you know?
Yeah, embrace your weirdness. Yeah, I think so. But I think that a lot of work can be done with men with autism to help them improve their kind of awareness of the cues that women might be giving, of social cues, and you can learn at that. Have you ever seen the television program Love on the Spectrum?
No.
It's a Netflix program, reality TV dating show for people with autism, and it's very heartwarming, but you can really see the struggle of how difficult it is for them to relate to a non-autistic person.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting too, if we think about a lot of the most successful people, at least professionally in the world, often there's something going on there. So it's like,
yes,
in a way, it's almost a sell for it of like, hey, they could be really freaking cool, you know?
Yeah, the tech bro, or if you know, maybe move to San Francisco and you're going to be, you know, high status there. I think that's a good point. Yeah. Because, you know, men's mate value has historically been very much linked to their status and their ability to accrue resources. Now, autism could be somewhat of a superpower there if you're in the tech arena, right?
Right,
coding
right.
And all that. To
get in the right room.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I love that. Okay, so what else are you... This is great. What else are you working on?
So we're also working on something called the sister guarding hypothesis, which is very, very different. So my supervisor and his former student developed about 10 years ago something called the daughter guarding hypothesis, which suggests that parents are more concerned with and motivated to interfere with the mating behavior of their daughter rather than their son.
Okay.
Because the idea behind this is that mating presents a whole host of risks for women that it doesn't for men. Erroneous mating decision for a woman is very hard to undo. Particularly in ancestral environments that our psychology evolved in. So what we're doing is we're testing whether that applies to siblings as well, because your sibling shares 50% of your genes. So you're concerned with what happens to them in their reproduction. So we predict that siblings will care more about their sisters than their brothers, and they'll exhibit behaviors to try and preserve their sister's mate value, to stop them being sexually exploited, and all of these things. And we're also going to just get a taxonomy of what kind of behaviors do they exhibit to interfere with the relationship decisions. We predict that they'll care more about their sister choosing a good partner, that they'll care more if they like or dislike their sister's partner versus their brother's. Mm. So that's kind of a very different project we're looking at.
So then the motivation, like you said, for the daughters, that one to me almost makes more sense. Mm-hmm. But then so not caring as much about the quality of partnership for a brother versus a sister, would that be partially because with the brother, the idea would be like, oh, he'll just deal with it. He'll figure it out. It's not the end of the world. He'll be fine.
Yes. Or even more kind of crude than that is that women represent a more valuable reproductive resource. You've kind of only got a finite amount of eggs that you can, of mating kind of decisions you can make.
Okay.
For a man, an erroneous mating decision can't go as wrong. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say a woman being sexually exploited might get pregnant, might get abandoned, left with that offspring. That's a lot more of a cost than a man who, he doesn't have much parental investment. He can still move on through life easier.
Yeah.
So that's our kind of psychology is attuned to all those things. And it's interesting because we have a kinship crisis whereby a lot of people, increasing families, are only having one child. And in the future, people won't have as many kin, cousins, sisters, brothers at all.
Yeah.
So understanding what they're lacking and this kind of sister guarding, it could be framed as pathological and too intense, and it's kind of suppressing female sexuality. And that's an extreme form, but there's also a pretty benevolent side of it, of caring about your sister's life, right? Caring whether she goes out with somebody who has a bad reputation, who might harm her. So if you have increasing numbers of women growing up without brothers who are interested in guarding their mating interests or siblings, they're kind of isolated, right? And like we spoke about earlier in the podcast, you know, the mating arena is something you're thrown into with not much education. If you lack siblings who are guarding your interest, that's even more isolated,
yeah.
Right? You have to maybe make mistakes and learn from it yourself for the first time without anyone caring about you. So we need to kind of think about how these things play out in sibling dynamics and what people might be missing if they don't have siblings. And when it can maybe get too extreme, because obviously too much sister guarding is suppression of female sexuality, and that's not great either. But yeah. Everything in evolution is like a trade-off. There's no clear-cut good or bad. It's a trade-off.
Yeah. This actually, for some reason, makes me think of, because of the sibling stuff and having mm-hmm. to do it solo, whatever. I listened to Theo Von's podcast mm-hmm. that came out sometime in the past few days. Maybe it was yesterday. I listened to it yesterday with Dax Shepard. Mm-hmm. And one, it was excellent. I had no idea that, I knew that Theo was in recovery, and now I know, and obviously if you've heard that mm-hmm. through me yet, like that's something I'm into. Mm-hmm. Addiction, alcoholism, anyway. And then I didn't know that Dax was, and I think that's actually more widely known because he's been around in that world for longer, yeah. But I just don't follow along with his storyline. So it was interesting to hear mm-hmm. their conversation. I really enjoyed that. But one of the things that Dax said was like, he like was like an odd looking kid and had like too many calyces, like his hair was just everywhere, you know, whatever. And then like 1 year when he was going into, I don't know whether it was middle school, I think it was middle school, maybe it was high school. Yeah, I think it was middle school. Anyway, he tells the story of his older sibling getting a hold of him, fixing his shit and being like, hey, this is you now. Gives him the skateboard, gives him the haircut, gives him like, this is how you do things now,
yes.
You know? And so that sibling then helped him. He went into the next school year and was able to attract like one of the girls that was like sought after, and it really changed the trajectory for him of like his own belief in his own capacity. So yet again, this is a full paraphrase of his story. I just listened to it yesterday and probably said some things incorrectly, but that's a very real time example of exactly what you're saying mm-hmm. of a sibling going like, come on, get under my wing. I'm gonna help you out here.
Yeah. So it's not just protecting them from the negative.
Yeah.
It could be actually promoting them and kind of directing them towards good decisions.
Right.
Or good tactics for improving themselves. Yeah. Very much so.
Okay, so what are you like excited about? Where do you see this work going? You're getting to work with this supervisor that's an absolute dream in reality, in real time. Mm-hmm. You live in Austin, you love it here. You're doing work right now that when you're on spring break, you're stoked to do. So mm-hmm. like, where do you see this stuff going? And then I think I guess I want to show appreciation for the fact that you're like trying to find ways to help people find mm-hmm. resources for this stuff, because it does matter. And even if it's a bit of a, I don't know, taboo topic or mm-hmm. sensitive topic, it's quite important. Yeah. So anyway, where do you see all this going for yourself?
So my research so far has been kind of foundational. We're just kind of exploring a subgroup of people who have never been researched before and seeing what's going on. So now from that foundational research, we know a bit about their psychological profile, their needs, what's going on. Now we need to maybe move towards intervention, and whether that looks like date coaching to help them improve their romantic prospects, or just mental health interventions to help them with their mental health first. And this, it'll all affect each other. So mm-hmm. improving their mental health will help them attract partners. Helping them attract partners will definitely improve their mental health. It's very bi-directional. Both things affect each other. But for each individual, you might need to focus on one first before the other. Because people who have poor mental health, they don't make for the best romantic partners, but also not being able to have a romantic relationship affects your mental health. So totally. You can kind of, it's cyclical like that. So I think I would like to move into the intervention type of thing in lots of different ways. I think it would maybe be important to start with the mental health professionals and train them about the needs of this group and what's going on and how to recognize it when you see it in the therapy room, because incels are very, very reluctant to access mental health support because yeah. they feel their problems are minimized whenever they raise them, and they're told they have male privilege and, you know, not to complain about this stuff. Often we encourage men to talk about their feelings, but when incels do, it often looks ugly, and men getting emotional doesn't always look warm and fuzzy. But we need to maybe work with mental health professionals to recognize what that looks like and the problems incels face and represent in society, so they can help them. Because I think I'll have a bit more success working with a bunch of professionals who want to learn how to better help people rather than incels who are already quite cynical. Incels might maybe go for a bespoke type of therapy that's designed with them in mind. Mm-hmm. Whereas now they're thinking, oh, if I go into therapy, it's just going to be someone who's going to dismiss my problems and just like always and feel kind of demeaned. Mm-hmm. I'd also like to do a study on the objective physical attractiveness of incels, to actually get a bunch of faces, maybe 40 or 50 faces, and get people to anonymously rate the attractiveness in the lab, because we don't know whether they're accurate or inaccurate about their physical attractiveness. So it's important to know, because apparently there's lots of reports about incels seeking very invasive cosmetic surgery to improve their physical attractiveness. And that could be out of body dysmorphia, or yeah. it could be out of an accurate perception. And if it's accurate, if they are accurate about their lack of physical attractiveness, then, you know, cosmetic surgery is something women have been doing for a long, long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not necessarily always the worst thing.
Yeah.
But it probably is a bad thing if it's coming out of some sort of body dysmorphia, right? So it's important to know one way or the other.
Yeah.
So I think I'd like to do that.
Well, and I love the idea of taking a look at whether the inner narrative is correct or incorrect, because once you believe something to be true, mm-hmm. you've got a real problem on your hands if it's in that negative direction, right? Yes. If I believe it to be true, for example, how many years did I show up to the gym and could never be, I'll never be, I'm not mm-hmm. an athlete, I'll never be. And then finally the right person says you can be. And now I believe it and I get significantly better a lot faster because my brain decided that it was actually possible.
Exactly.
This also, what was it? There was something else that you made me think of with that, just the emotional, one of the things, so I do coaching, right? Mm-hmm. I do coaching online. And one of the things I've implemented with the online individuals is just this check-in sheet. And what has come across to me that is the consistent theme, like every person shows up for a different reason. And what we work on, some of them is different, right? Mm-hmm. Their own subset of needs and so on. That being said, what's become abundantly clear to me is that their perception of how they performed in what I asked them to do mm-hmm. versus their actual performance based on habit change, how this thing works, whatever, the disparity is like jarring.
Wow.
It's been really, it's been like cool and then uncool. Cause then you can finally like real time with this individual unpack their check-in where they've rated themselves on a scale of 1 to 5 or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is such simple stuff, yeah. but they come in and they say they would rate their blank behavior this, and then they tell me what they did.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you're insane. And mm-hmm. we're all crazy, yeah. you know, but like with love, do you, the way that you speak to yourself
right.
is so outlandish.
Yes.
And so it's such a powerful thing to be able to like collaborate with him and saying like, this is bonkers.
Yeah.
The homework that I gave you, you completely executed. Mm-hmm. Like, and yet you rated it this. You did exactly what you were supposed to do, and yet you still think that it yes. was wildly insufficient.
Yeah. And incels, like, they score very high on rejection sensitivity and cognitive distortion. So they're perceiving being slighted by the world at every turn, when it might not actually be the case. So right. a lot of just old-fashioned CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, would be very, very beneficial if they would embrace it. But I think there's that disconnect between what they think, that feeling of that they're going to be dismissed by the therapist. So I think we need to crack that first, yeah. and then they might buy into it.
And it does make sense. I do think the whole talk therapy thing, there's a lot of, I have mm-hmm. opinions about mm-hmm. that, having successfully experienced that and having unsuccessfully experienced yes. that, like as a person who's pretty relatable, I guess, I don't know. I mm. like humans. I get along with them well, very outgoing, like obnoxiously so. Mm. So that would be something that maybe like a rate of success would go up for yes. an individual like me, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And yet I've experienced where I've sat down and been like, this is not it. This yeah. is not, we're not, this ain't it, you yeah. know? So I can only imagine if I already come in thinking I don't have good odds mm-hmm. here, and then I experience that, how I'm going to perceive that to be.
Yeah.
So I don't know. What do you think? When I think of talk therapy and the success that I've experienced, it's when that individual had, like, I've done a bit more homework on them mm-hmm. and like, okay, so I'm going to you because I want to get better in these areas of life mm-hmm. that I'm aware of at this time. And maybe I'm a delusional creature and I'm going to find out some other stuff I need to work on because that's yeah. human. But you seem to have a quality of life that's desirable to me. Mm-hmm. Those are things that seem to like work well for me when I'm yes. doing my own investigation as the person who's going to pay for the service.
Yeah. I think that's the number one predictor of success in the therapeutic alliance is rapport with the client and just that unconditional positive regard from someone you respect.
Yeah.
So it's like role modeling successful behavior. This person who's got their life together is very well-dressed, successful, has unconditional positive regard for me. That alone would be beneficial for socially anxious, lonely young men, I
yeah.
think.
Yep.
So, yeah, creating that therapeutic alliance, that rapport, hugely important. So very important for therapists to not alienate their client by dismissing their problems or saying, oh, come on, there's someone out there for everyone, or you're not facing any real problems, you know, just, you know, get better dressed or whatever. You know, they demean the problems.
Yeah.
And that makes the incel feel like, oh, they don't really understand.
Right. You know? So what resources do you know of or offer personally at this time for incels and just people struggling?
So at the moment, I'm still just doing research about the community myself and try and shine a light on things that I think are very important, like their mental health. My co-author and colleague, Dr. Andrew Thomas, he's actually qualified to deliver therapy, and he works with a number of incels who've got in touch with him on the back of our research. So I would point any incels or men who are struggling towards him, because that's his area of research and he delivers therapy as well. So he's the kind of the exact guy you would want in that situation.
Okay.
But ultimately what we'd like to do is maybe work with groups of therapists to design a type of therapy and train the therapists rather than train the incels to access therapy.
Yeah.
I think it's better to create the service for them and then pitch it to them. Say, look, we've designed this something bespoke with your needs in mind. Would you give it a go?
Yeah.
That's a bit better than saying, try therapy for the 100th time. Go on. It's going to work this time. I promise. You know, I think you have to actually design something specifically with their needs in mind.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the idea of you also coaching for it too, mm-hmm. just because I can see people being like really drawn to working specifically with you based on your compassion for the the demographic. Like based on, I mean, you've chosen to just do so much work that there's no way that you're not a resource to these individuals.
And incels are very cynical about most academic research, because most academic research that focuses on this topic takes a very cynical lens and just tries to go for the low-hanging fruit of saying how bad they are.
Yeah.
Right? They're very misogynistic. They're say awful things on the internet. We know. That's obvious. You can
wait,
see
so
that
why
clearly.
Don't you do that?
Because I think there's a more depth than that. I think that incels, what they say on the internet is very, very ugly, but it's very, very performative. Mm-hmm. It's almost like performance art. It's so caricature. And behind that kind of lashing out is real social pain.
Right.
And the kind of, you know, from the actual research, when we actually embrace the community directly, we find way more potentiality for self-harm than harm to others. So, yes, one part of the story is, yes, they say horrifically ugly things on the internet. That's a problem. That might be diminished if we can help improve their mental health.
Yes.
People who are mentally well don't tend to say horrifically ugly things on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about, you know, and all our research points to mental health being the biggest predictor of the problematic attitudes.
Yeah.
So if we intervene at that level, it can help society all round and get rid of the misogyny alongside improving their mental health.
I think it's been such a powerful tool these past few years for me of being in my recovery journey and actually picking up some new tools for life. One of them being to, there's this prayer called the sick man's prayer. Mm. And it's just like, pray, which also then that's wild in and of itself, because for many years I was like, don't do the God thing. Get away from me. Don't do that. I will not be. And then I got desperate enough that I decided to do it. Now I love it anyway. But it's about tolerance and pity and love for an individual. Grant them the same bits of that you would someone who is sick, you know? And anyway, there are just a number of different tools today that, like, at the end of the day, someone who is acting out is acting out often from a place of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't, like, even if you were hurt by their actions, like, indirectly is less intense. Directly, even if you were directly harmed by their lashing out, their poor behavior, their whatever, if they attacked, you know, whatever it is, we still don't want sick people out there.
Yeah.
And so why not want them to get well?
Yeah. So there's two ways you can look at it. You can say, number one, they're more dangerous to themselves. So for that reason alone, it's worth intervening at the level of mental health.
Right.
But also, even if your only concern was their potential for damage to other people, still, it's mental health that predicts that the most.
Right.
So whichever kind of concern you have, whether you have empathy for incels at all, even if you don't, even if you're only worried about their potential to damage other people, it's mental health is the level we should intervene at, because that's predicting those attitudes.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay. This is awesome. Thank you. Okay. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Like, this is cool.
Really
Yeah. I'm excited to just continue to follow along with your journey and see you in the gym crushing it.
Yes.
So I do like to end every episode with, I ask every guest, this is not anything too crazy, what are three things you're grateful for today?
Ooh, number one, I said to you before we started recording that joining Onnit in January 2024 has been the first time in a long, long time that I've been able to get consistency with the gym, going three times at least a week, and it's going good, really enjoying it.
What do you, it's like totally selfish plug, what do you love about it? Like, why do you like Onnit?
It's very motivational to see the shape that everyone there is in, like, oh my God, you cannot bring any ego into that gym.
Yeah.
Everyone is in great shape, but everyone's very encouraging. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the second thing I'm most grateful for, is here in Austin, compared to other big cities, it's very encouraging and people want to see you win and they're kind of inspired by your victories, and they're not trying to tear you down, and it's not very competitive with each other on that level. It's competitive with each other in terms of trying to motivate each other and being motivated by someone else's success. And thirdly, it's just, to have found a field and a career and passion that I'm interested in. I said to you before we started recording that once you find something that you love, you'll work harder than you've ever done before, but the tools will feel light in your hands. And that's kind of how I feel. I'm excited to go to work every day. which is a great feeling. I can't imagine what it would be like to hate every Monday morning. So,
and it's probably hard. It's like hard. It's that they feel light in your hands, and it was probably hard to find your way there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you probably still have to work hard and have long hours and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And yet it's worth it.
For sure.
Hardwired for hard work. We're just that. We're just that. And if you're not working hard and you're not loving life, do some stuff. Okay. So my three gratitudes today will be that I am grateful for people's kindness. So I've been like on this freaking hives journey for over a month now. I've had hives. Oh. Yesterday, I actually went into work on it and I counted 54 on me the morning of. Whoa. And I was so like, I was finally like, it's already been bothersome. Like that's uncomfortable when you don't know what's going on with your body, all of that. And it feels out of your control. And I had seen a dermatologist a couple weeks ago who gave me a specific regimen. It's not really working. And I also, anyway, so went in yesterday and was like embarrassed. Like I was literally working with my clients. I'm like, I'm so sorry. Like I wanted to like cover up and be like, I'm so, and you know, of course everyone else just shows such compassion and they're so kind. But as a result of communicating like, oh, I'm really uncomfortable and I don't know what's going on. Multiple people reached out and gave me their resources, what they've done. And so I am grateful for people's kindness and some of not only the like just specific resources, but the accompaniment of like kind messages of just like, you're not alone, you know? And as much as I'm this extroverted creature that, you know, whatever, like even for me, from these individuals, one girl that I can think of that she's a member on it, she's basically a stranger to me, what she sent me and the kindness and like, you're not alone in this and I'm going to check back in and I'm thinking of you and I'll, you know, like that was so kind of her to do. So anyway, I'm grateful for that. I'm also grateful for the fact that today I really enjoy time inside my own brain. There were many years where I wouldn't even do that. And certainly when I was told I had to, I really didn't like it. And so going down to San Antonio to record a podcast before this and coming back, that was like 3 hours in the car to myself. And I was like so stoked to have a moment to just be solo. That's really cool. And then the third thing I'll be grateful for today is literally just this platform, both being able to, like you talked about, you know, you started to create this university in your car, you know, and so being able to like hang out with your heroes, in that way is so cool. And even if they're not your heroes, but they're great at hosting wonderful conversations. Great. You know, being able to access that, being able to have you on as a guest, being able to go be a guest on something like this platform is so cool. So anyway, those are mine for the day. Where can people find you, support you, consume your content, keep up with what's going on?
I think the best place to follow me is on Twitter or X. So that's my handle is at Costello William. And that's where you'll hear about all my new work.
Okay. Okay. Easy enough. That will be in the description. I'm going to go ahead and I'll get that in the description. And I will also get that colleague of yours that you specifically referenced.
Yes.
I'll make sure that that's down there too. So good that idea. If this resonates with them or whatever, they can contact.
Yep.
So thank you again for your time. If you've been listening and if you didn't already know, I do offer online coaching. And so that's something I always have to plug that I offer one-to-one and group setting coaching. You get customized programming, you get custom meal plans. The coaching, there are a few different tiers. So whether it's biweekly check-ins, monthly, there's just a bunch of different options. So if that speaks to you, if you want help, if you want to move better, feel better, and you know, you want to work on your mindset, whatever, reach out to me and that'll be in the description as well. Finally, your time, listener, is very valuable. So the fact that you have chosen to come spend it with us in this way means a lot to me, and I bet it means a lot to William as well.
Thanks.
And so we appreciate you and just hope that you choose to have a beautiful day.